All right, so week two of going through the Alpha topics. Last year we went through Alpha. As we were going through the Alpha course, we were inviting people at Alpha on a Sunday to hear people's journeys with Jesus, their life stories. This year we've been inviting them to come along on a Sunday if they'd like, and to one of our services and to hear a bit more on the topic. So last week we looked at the question of, is this it? Is there more to life than this? And we had Alpha for a second week this last Tuesday, and the question was, Jesus, who is he? And I've chosen John 8, 12 to 32 to sort of ground us in a little bit, but we're not going to be going through, it was a reasonably long reading as well, we won't be going through all of that. There's a lot of statements that Jesus made about himself there, and I guess John 8 doesn't stand on its own, does it? It's a passage where Jesus says something of who he is, and he does that in many, many places. John's gospel, actually, he seems to do that, he seems to do that a lot in John's gospel, actually. There's all the I am statements that a lot of them seem grounded in John's gospel. This passage, chapter 8, verse 12, comes on the back of a previous passage, John 8, 1 to 11. Funnily enough, that's as you would expect. But John 8, 1 to 11 is a passage which doesn't appear in all manuscripts of the Bible. And it's one which some people take issue with. It's one of my favourite ones, as it so happens. It's Jesus being tested also by the teachers of the law when they brought a woman to him who had been caught in the act of adultery. And they, we're told, brought him so that they could trap him. Do you remember that? I'm sure you remember that story. It's that story where a bunch of people who are so have such an issue with Jesus and who he is that they actually bring somebody else, a third party, a woman who's caught in adultery, and they bring her to him in a public place. And they do this in verse 6 of chapter 8. It says, they were using this question to trap Jesus. What is the question? Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery, verse 4, verse 5. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. Now, what do you say? They brought a real-life human being. Let's just not forget that. A real-life human being as a part of their game because of their own insecurities and their own confusion. And they brought her embarrassingly, full of shame, in front of everybody else, so as to trap Jesus. Can you see how messed up that is? It's pathetic. And so Jesus, if you continue to read through, says, if he does this thing, second half of verse 6, but Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. I don't know what's going on there. I've read stuff about what Jesus wrote, read lots of interesting stuff. Nobody knows whether any of it's true, but people have decided Jesus wrote this or this or this or whatever. Perhaps he wrote something and the woman could see, but nobody else could. Who knows? Maybe he wrote down in the ground the sin that everybody else was guilty of. Because he then, when they kept on questioning him, it says in verse 7, straightens up and says to them, if any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. Again, he stooped down and he writes on the ground again. Weirdo. What's he doing? Verse 9, at this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman. It's interesting, isn't it? The young ones are there going, oh, I still want to stone her. The older ones are going, I think at this stage in my life, I'm pretty convinced that I've done stuff that I shouldn't have done. I'm not without sin. And so the older ones lead the example, don't they? As they walk away, drop their stones and leave the woman alone. Well, we come to this passage in verse 12. Jesus says one of those statements. It's just one of those far-out statements, amazing statements, crazy statements. Jesus spoke again to the people. It says, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. You know, just another day, really. Here he is making massive statements and claims. I'm the light of the world. That's a big claim. But not only that, if you follow him, it's not just that you'll be following the light, but you'll actually then have the light as well. And so he makes a claim that if you follow him, you'll be impacted. At the moment, if you don't follow him, you're in darkness, you're blind, you're lost. If you follow him, then suddenly you'll be a part of not just being found, but also become a part of that light of the world yourself. And so Jesus sort of throws this down, and there's some Pharisees there. And so the Pharisees, they've got an issue with this, of course. And in verse 13, we're told that they shout back at him, "Here you are, appearing as your own witness. Your testimony is not valid." Now, I've got a picture there. It's a black and white picture of somebody giving testimony. It's a black and white photo, so it's probably from biblical times. And in that, we all know from American, from Law and Order, dun dun, if you watch Law and Order, shows like that, we know what a witness is, what a testimony is. A witness is needed to confirm the truth. Now, it's not always because somebody's lying. Sometimes it's actually because people don't know. They forgot, or they were confused, or they had a lack of clarity in a situation. And a testimony can bear witness to what is actually the truth. When I was 19 years old, I had a car. It was a Suzuki Hatch. A Suzuki Hatch, don't think Suzuki Swift. Do you remember the Suzuki Mighty Boys? They had this like a little ute. It was a silly little thing. Suzuki Hatch was like the station wagon version, but it's just a two-seat thing. It had a three-cylinder 0.8 of a litre motor. It was basically a four-wheeled motorbike wrapped in tinfoil. And that was my first car. I was so proud. And so one Saturday morning, I was driving along to go up to Pete's Ridge to go horse riding with some friends I was going to meet there, and I was in the car by myself. And I was driving along, and I came to the intersection of Frederick and Elizabeth Street in Asheville, right next to Asheville Pool. Do you remember, do you know that, where that is? And I remember very clearly where it was, because it was, I had to write it on a number of things after that. And it was at 7:28 in the morning, that as I was going through the green light in my Suzuki Hatch, somebody in a Ford Falcon station wagon, if you remember the 80s and Ford Falcon station wagons, that is a tank, came through a red light, and Suzuki Hatch and Ford Falcon met in a beautiful moment, which I didn't even see him coming, but it sent me spinning. Do you know what the crumple zone of a vehicle is? It's the bit that is designed to crumple in an impact. I discovered that the Suzuki Hatch, the crumple zone actually ends in the back seat. The whole front of the car just disintegrated. I was trapped. I hit the steering wheel so hard, because the seatbelt didn't stop me, that I perforated my bowel, because my intestines were pushed against my vertebrae so hard that I was bleeding internally. And so the whole world starts going around. There's this massive bang. World goes around, and then everything stops. And then this lady who was a nurse coming off duty at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, she was driving behind me, and she went through the set of lights behind me and pulled over. And she went and saw the guy in the Ford Falcon, and he was pretty dazed, but he was also stuck in his Ford Falcon, believe it or not. The little Suzuki did enough damage to the Ford Falcon to stop him getting out. And I was trapped in my car. And so she went and saw him, and then she came over to me, and she said, "You were going through a green light." And I said, I know. And she said, "I was going through after you. I saw the whole thing." I said, "I know. Yeah, that's great." And she said, "He's saying that his light was green." And I went, "Oh." And she said, "I said to him, though, no." And he said, "You're only saying that because you were in the other car." And I said, "No, I wasn't in the other car. I'm an independent witness." And so the police came and visited me in casualty while I was there waiting for my operation that I was about to have. And the policeman just said to me, he said, You said the light was green when you went through. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "The other guy said the light was green when he went through." I went, "Okay." And then he said, "But there was an independent witness. And they said the light was green when you went through. And it can't be green both ways. And so we're charging him." I went, "Oh, why? What solved that problem? Independent witness." I had a friend a few years later who was involved in a car accident. And there was an independent witness who appeared magically after the event from the other side, and he ended up in a lot of trouble. Independent witness makes the difference. And so the Pharisees here, they're saying, you can't go around telling us who you are. You can't make these claims. There needs to be somebody else to verify this. Now, the interesting thing is that they've got a point, haven't they? I mean, if we just listen to the claims of anybody, we'd be in trouble because we're not always honest and we also don't always remember things accurately. Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but there's this thing called social media. And on social media, young people today, and I'm young people today, find ourselves getting very confused about what reality is, especially about ourselves. I was reading an article by somebody who is of the younger generation, who has grown up using Instagram. And she wrote an article, her name's Emily Weber, and she wrote an article which says this about Instagram in particular. It says, as an image-centric app, people tend to selectively present themselves. This may come as a shock to you, okay? So just let me let you down gently that on things like Instagram, people tend to selectively present themselves, only showcasing the highlights of their lives. This is also a natural human tendency, only wanting to post your best photo, conveniently taken in the perfect slimming angle. See? Anyway. And only sharing the happiest of moments. It makes us feel strong and confident. It's all sounding good so far. What do young people need in their lives? They need this, surely, where they can present themselves slim, young, strong, confident, happy. But it goes on, of course. However, having access to a billion individuals' life highlight reel is actually extremely damaging, especially while uncovering your personal identity. See, this is what young people are going through. They're still trying to discover who they are, and they are bombarded. I believe Instagram, if you look at how many people are active once a month or more on Instagram, there's a billion people. That was a couple of years ago, so it's probably more, I don't know. But that's a lot of highlight reels, a whole lot. And for you, as you present your best pictures about you, do so knowing that they're your best pictures and that maybe that's not really you. And in the meantime, you're getting a billion images back from other people that all shout to how perfect they are. It actually starts to erode and damage our understanding of ourselves. It means that we're actually not a very good witness to ourselves as to who we are. And so as we read on, Emily also says this, people subconsciously grow to feel inferior if they do not meet the standards they are constantly seeing through their screens. Constantly seeing images of happy, slim, fit, perfect, successful people. According to that bunch of research people, this will serve to intensify the issues of identity development and interpersonal connectedness, challenging adolescents to confront them with greater constancy and urgency. We have an epidemic of confusion with regards to identity as to who we actually are. And the things like social media, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff, is only causing this confusion to get more. And so there's some facts that come out of all of this, if you haven't been paying attention, and hopefully you'll see where this comes back to some of the things Jesus is saying about himself. Fact, we are rarely the best witness to our own identity. We rarely are. When it comes to, not just, you're the best person to tell me about how you feel about something and what's going on inside of you, if you're in touch with it. But when it comes to actually who it is that other people are, sometimes we are not a good witness to our own identity. We tend to present ourselves as better than we are. That's social media. And we are clouded by comparison and our perception of others. That's what this research is saying. We just get so clouded and confused in all of that. We really don't know where other people are up to. And we certainly don't know where we are up to in the midst of that. Comparison is such a hard thing. It just confuses things so much more. Jesus, however, is not like this. And this is the point that I'm getting to. I've said this before. Have you ever noticed how Jesus doesn't seem confused about where he's going? He doesn't seem confused about what he's supposed to do. He seems to have this clarity. He seems to have this mission that he's on. He seems to know where he's heading. He knows who his father is. Look at some of the statements that we had read for us this morning. This connection that he has with the father, he knows who he is. He constantly makes statements about who he is and where he's going, and that's his answer to their demand that he needs another testimony, another witness as to who he is. Do you see what he says? He says this: even if I testify on my own behalf, my testimony is valid, for I know where I came from and I know where I am going. I know my mission. I know my purpose. I know my values. And if you look at, read through what we had read for us this morning, I know the Father. The Father knows me. What more is there? I don't need to present a photo of me on a good hair day. I don't need to do that. There's a consistency. There's an anchor for Jesus. There's something solid that is going on there, because he's not looking at other people and going, I need to be like that, or I need to be like that. Comparison doesn't come into it for Jesus. Jesus knows. And so he can say that he comes to us as the light of the world. What other statements does he makes? He says, I'm the bread of life. And we go, wow, that's a big statement. Jesus just knows what that means. We're still going to unravel that. He says, I'm the good shepherd. He says, I am living water. He makes all these crazy statements about who he is, but it comes from a place of knowing where he's come from and where he's going. If we were to make statements like that, it would come from a place of confusion rather than what Jesus has. And this is all at the age of 30-something. I had an interesting conversation with somebody after the 8:30 service, and they just said, like, when they were young and they met Jesus, Jesus was their friend, and he thought Jesus was a 30-year-old, and now he's 70, getting close to 80. He looks at Jesus, and he thinks Jesus is a 70 or 80-year-old. Somehow maybe trapped in a 33-year-old's body, I don't know. But the more we get to know Jesus and the depth with which Jesus comes, I've talked about first and second half of life at times. Richard Rohr wrote a book called Falling Upwards, which is about first and second half of life. And one of the things that's interesting is, if you understand first and second half, Jesus' teachings are second half of life teachings from somebody who's 33, which is really amazing. First half of life is about externals. And when you realize that your externals are going to let you down, you have a midlife crisis, and if all goes well, you then come into your second half of life where you realize it's who you are. It's the contents, not the container. Jesus, right off the bat, is talking about contents, not the container. Why did Jesus come when he came? Because he didn't need Instagram. That's why. It wouldn't have helped him. So David Benner wrote an interesting book about identity, and it challenged me. It's called The Gift of Being Yourself. I've shared it before. I'm reading it a second time. But the interesting thing about The Gift of Being Yourself, it's about me finding my identity, who I am in Christ, who I am as a child of God. But the thing I found really challenging about it, but I didn't really expect it at the time, and I think I mentioned it before, was the way that he unpacks Jesus understanding Jesus' identity. I never thought about that. Jesus is fully God, yet he's also fully human. And as a man who is growing up from going through a boy, teenager, adolescent, young adult, he goes through, maybe in some ways, we don't know how he goes through it, but he actually does have this understanding of who he is. But David Benner says some interesting things about identity, which I found really helpful as we think about who Jesus is and how Jesus understands himself. Perhaps the most revealing of the gospel accounts about Jesus' understanding of his vocation is that presented in Luke 4. What happens in Luke 4? Jesus walks into the synagogue. Apparently he did this a little bit. He's a teacher of the law, so he can walk into the synagogue. He can pull out a scroll. He can choose a passage. He can read it. He can teach on it. And so unrolling the scroll, it says, Jesus selected and read the following words, and David Benner quotes what Jesus reads. It's from the prophet Isaiah, of course. The Spirit of the Lord has been given to me. Jesus chooses this, reads this out. The Spirit of the Lord has been given to me For he has anointed me. He has sent me to bring the good news to the poor, to proclaim liberty to captives and to the blind new spirit, new sight, to set the downtrodden free, to proclaim the Lord's year of favor. Me. The interesting thing is David Benner goes on, he points this out. As he finished, every eye in the synagogue is on Jesus. The unspoken question in everyone's mind is, who is this man who dares to take upon himself the mantle of the Messiah, the chosen one, the Savior, the one who will save God's people? And Benner says, Jesus heard the unspoken question and answered with shocking directness. This text is being fulfilled today, even as you listen. Jesus always seems to understand who he is, doesn't he? He understands where he's come from. He understands where he's going. And at this point, I don't think anybody else understands that that's going to be a cross. But Jesus gets it. So even if he testifies on his own behalf, he knows who he is. Well, the interesting thing is that David Benner goes on to make another comment, which I think is helpful for us as we understand ourselves, but also understanding Jesus. And one of the things, if you have read theology down through like people like Calvin, as well as Augustine and various other people, one of the things that as a statement that comes through from Christian thought from many, many years ago, right from the early church through today, which has never really been disputed, is that to really know God, you've got to know yourself. And to really know yourself, you've got to really know God. They go hand in hand. What does that mean? Well, maybe this goes some way to explain it. Benner says this, there are many false ways of achieving uniqueness. In other words, you can try and create yourself as a unique individual if you like. He says, these all result from attempts to create a self rather than receive the gift of myself in Christ. And that's social media. Social media, we feel, in social media, we're able to create our identity. We just present what we want to, and that becomes our identity. But of course, that's not true, is it? Whatever we put out there on social media, and social media, by the way, is, I hope you're all with me, is just one example of how we do this. We can do it at morning tea in a moment without a phone. We can go to morning tea this morning and present our very best and not our true self. But it'll just be what we've formulated, what we've put together for others to see. He's saying you don't get to create yourself. God's already created you. And so he goes on to say, but the uniqueness that comes from our true self is not a uniqueness of our own making. Now, one of the things that David Benner goes on to say is that you actually are unique. Have you noticed that one of the things that happens with social media, with Instagram, is everybody actually becomes very much the same? And often in the church, we think we're supposed to all become the same. And then we end up with services that are traditional or contemporary or family, as we all just try and cater to be sort of in some sort of sameness. You being you, you're actually very unique. You're a one-off. You're a one-of-a-kind. And God's especially fond of you. This isn't about becoming like Jesus so that we all look the same. It's becoming like Jesus so that we are our own unique self. And so he goes on to say, identity is never simply a creation. It is always a discovery. True identity is always a gift of God. Now, one of the things I think after the 8:30 service, I just wondered if I bummed everybody else out a little bit too much. Can I just say that I don't really get me. I get me more than I did, but I'm still on that journey. And that's a part of life for all of us. We sometimes hide our true self so much from ourselves, even, that we become confused. And I can relate to that. I assume you can at some level. But there's good news, because Jesus allows us to follow his example. He invites us to. The way, the life, and the truth. That's about you knowing who you are, discovering who you are as you discover who Jesus is.
is.
So, I always used to wonder about Matthew 7, 28 to 29. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teachings because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. And I always used to wonder about that. Why did Jesus have such an impact? But why is it that when he spoke, people went, oh, wow, he's got authority. The teachers of the law had authority. Teachers of the law are the ones who actually ultimately got Jesus to hang on a cross and die. Such was their sway with the Roman authority. Why is it that when Jesus opened his mouth, the guy who had no worldly possessions, had half a dozen followers, was able to open his mouth and people go, wow, he's got authority. What is the go with that? No, one of the reasons I think is that if I open my mouth and speak, if you open your mouth and speak, at some point we trip ourselves up with our own agenda, with our own motives. He didn't have those. They could look at him and go, he always seems to understand what he's on about. He always seems to understand where he's come from. He always seems to understand where he's going. He always seems anchored. And this is who Jesus was. This is who Jesus is. He's not influenced by those around him. He was the original influencer. So, we come to verse 30 in our passage, and like I said, I really haven't covered much of what's in John 8, but we're going to run out of time. Even as he spoke, many put their faith in him, the one who said outrageous things about himself. Absolutely outrageous. And yet somebody who seemed to have this anchor in who he was, where he had come from. And please don't miss the testimony that he bears with regards to who he is, because it's intimately connected to him understanding who his Father is. And so the truth, he goes on to say, will set you free in verse 32. He says, verse 31, to the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, if you hold to my teachings, you are really my disciples, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So who is Jesus? Jesus is an amazing teacher who made massive claims. But more than the claims he made is the way he lived. This man who seemed to understand where he'd come from and where he was going. And I alluded to the fact that he understood that where he was going to ultimately was to the cross, which is probably the last thing maybe this morning as we come to the table, to his table, for us to think about. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Often when we look at the idea of him being the way, we look at him as being the means through which we have eternal life. He's the way. But that's not how it was meant in the early church by his disciples when they said, we're a part of the way. It's a whole way of walking. It's a whole way of understanding who you are. It's a whole way of knowing where you've come from and where you're going. And so Jesus, in full confidence of that, goes on to say this as he's sharing a meal with his disciples towards the end. And I guess this comes to the table, brings us to the table now. Jesus takes bread, gives thanks, breaks it, gives it to them and says, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Another outrageous claim, yes? Yet he understands who he is. It's not an outrageous claim for him. It's one of great clarity, really. He knows where he's heading. He's heading to the cross. He's been called by his Father to uphold things such as love, such as sacrifice, such as authenticity, such as the kingdom, those sorts of values. They undergird who he is and what he's going to do. And he invites us into that.